Well, that is a remnant of a crude idea which was very prevalent at the beginning of modern thirds, that every human institution was due to a human inventor, that law and morals and writing and everything was at one stage designed by some great genius. That's, of course, all nonsense. We do not owe laws to legislators or kings, but states became possible because people had evolved rules which they obeyed and then found it convenient to create an apparatus to enforce these rules because they were always lawbreakers. Even historically, the idea that you could make laws is an extraordinarily late one. We know too little about the really early periods, and it's still sometimes asserted that, say, Hammurabi, the great Assyrian legislator, invented his code of laws. I think from all we know about later periods, it's practically certain that he just put on paper, or rather on stone, rules which had long existed and been enforced. It becomes quite clear when we turn to classical antiquity, where law was long an evolving thing, where judges were appealed to find the law which was supposed to exist, and where the gradual accumulation of legal precedents which evolved as science of law. In fact, when you ask yourself, what was the situation in any civilization which had a large degree of personal freedom, whether it was Greece of the 5th century BC or the Roman Republic just about the turn of the beginning of, just before the beginning of the Christian era, you would find that the idea that anybody had the power to make new laws would have seemed absurd. Law was something which the judges had to find by applying principles which were supposed to have existed forever to the particular case. It was very late in classical antiquity that finally the accumulation of these law of precedence was codified by the Emperor Justinian, and then you had a written law. But the same process by which classical Roman law developed was again that there was a basic law which was not the result of human invention or human design, the application of which the judges had gradually to elaborate, and where the body of law was not the result of anybody's deliberate invention, but a product of solving practically the problems of life by applying these principles which had evolved in the course of time. Now, such law has certain very characteristic properties. A law which evolves through precedents, through judicial decisions, can be applied only to new cases by a technique of abstraction. The lawyers and the judges learn clearly to distinguish what is peculiar to the particular case and what is a general rule which can be abstracted from the particular case and applied equally to future cases where certain formal properties are lived. Wherever law is of the common law type, it is therefore of the essence of law in the true sense that exists of general rules equally applicable to everybody and is sharply distinguished from orders issued by an authority requiring particular people to do particular things. This sharp distinction between law in the sense of general rules and law in the sense of an order emanating from an authority requiring particular people to do particular things gets rapidly lost once legislation is introduced. Now, legislation, unfortunately, cannot be fully avoided. It cannot be avoided because the process of evolution of law by jurisdiction, by following precedent, is a one-way process. You can never reverse it by jurisdiction because the judge is bound by previous decision. If anything turns out to have been a mistake, and the development of common law has been directed on a wrong track, there's no way of reversing it except that of formal legislation. Yet the same process of formal legislation is unfortunately not subject to the same limitations to which the common law is subject. Once you regard everything which a duly authorized legislative authority lays down as a law, irrespective of its contents, you are now in a position to make a specific order which requires people to do particular things, or which differentiates, which discriminates between people, as much as a law, as valid, as a true law in the sense of the common law. Now, to understand this distinction is extraordinarily important if we want to comprehend what the founders of this country and the great libertarian thinkers of England were aiming at when they believed that freedom was secured by the rule of law, by a government of laws and not of men. In all these phrases, the term law is used in a sense which we have now lost, a sense which has become confused, because once the process of lawmaking passed from the judges to legislatures of one kind or other, it became much wider. The old belief, which we derive from classical antiquity and which was so strong in 17th and 18th century England and which dominated the fathers of the American Constitution, that liberty is always liberty under the law, and that law is the most important protection of personal freedom. I'm getting anxious because I brought a manuscript along and it isn't here now, which I need. What did I do with it? There must be a typescript lying about somewhere here. Well, we'll find it later.
It isn't in your book there, is it?
No. I was looking for a quotation, that's why I suddenly knew you said that it isn't here.
This happened to be it here, is that just something marking?
Yeah, it's just a small thing. Do it, excuse me for a moment, because it's a manuscript for which I intend to lecture and use from all the courses. Well, it will turn.
What size is it?
Well, it's an ordinary type, this sort of thing like this. I probably left
it.
No, I didn't. I probably just left it in.
Did you leave it in your room, maybe?
I told him next to the man. Don't stop. No, I will have to go myself, but I should be first go right. If I don't find it, I can give the lecture for memory too. And if I, it was just a question of now putting John Locke verbatim in a certain connection, that might occur to me, but I think I can remember what I was looking for. What I was saying is this. In the 17th and 18th century, it was not only taken for granted that law was not a restriction of permanent liberty, of personal liberty, but law was the essential condition for the existence of permanent, of private liberty. That we are free, as Cicero had expressed it, because we serve the laws. And that the one important safeguard against any restriction of liberty was that the relation between private individuals, as well as the relations between private individuals and the state, was strictly subject to the law. Now, this was a concept which had a perfectly clear meaning so long as the law was essentially of the nature of the common law. Because the rules which emerged from the process of following precedent were in their nature abstract general rules of such a kind that they would have to be applied in the same manner to all people, that people were equal before the law. It is true that as evolution became more rapid, for the reasons I've already indicated, it became impracticable to rely for the development of the law entirely on jurisdiction. It became occasionally necessary to correct a mistake which the judges had made, or to alter rules which people began to regard as no longer appropriate or just by a deliberate process. But when in the 18th century it was conceived that so long as the administration or executive was in all its actions bound by the law, the term law still meant, particularly the authors of the American Constitution, not anything passed by the duly appointed legislative authority, but it meant only those general rules which can be the law to everybody, which apply equally to all men, and which are the only basis on which government is ever entitled to use coercion vis-a-vis the private citizens. Now, before I go on to distinguish this kind of law, which is a protection of liberty, from the other kind of law which we now know, which can be used so extensively to suppress personal liberty, let me make an attempt to define more precisely the criteria by which we recognize true laws in the material or substantive sense, from things to which we now give the complementary title of law, because they are a resolution of a duly appointed legislative body, but which do not have this character. Our true laws, in the first place, must be what I have called general or abstract. That means they must contain no reference to particular places, times, or individuals. They must contain no proper names of persons or places. That is what we mean by them, that they apply equally to everybody, that they do not discriminate between people. The whole of our common law and our criminal law are, of course, of this type. The second point is that such general rules should apply only to the relations between people or the relations between individuals and the government, but should not apply or not regulate anything the individual does in his purely private sphere. It would not be justified, these laws, if these laws regulated the action of the individual which does not affect the person. Thirdly, these laws, in the true sense, must be what I can briefly call only impartial. They must make no provisions which clearly discriminate against a particular group or favor a particular group. That is the most difficult requirement to define, but it is also important. That our laws, even in the most advanced and libertarian regime, make some distinction between classes of persons is clear. For instance, we have, even in every legal system I know, special rules applying to women which do not apply to men, or special rules applying to children which do not apply to grown ups. Now, most of them could in fact be formulated in a form which doesn't specifically name a particular group. If the criminal law, I beg ladies' pardon, does prohibit rape, I don't think it's necessary to say that no woman need be raped. I think you could express this prohibition in a form which doesn't specify a woman. But I think the essential point is rather the different one. The requirement of impartiality demands that wherever a distinction is being made between different groups of people, this distinction is as much approved by the people included in the group singled out as by the people excluded from the group singled out. If there is a legal provision specially naming women, and it is as much approved by the woman as by the man, it's neither privilege nor discrimination. If it happened to be approved only by the woman and not by the man, it would be privilege. If it were disapproved by the woman and approved only by the man, it would clearly be discrimination against the woman. So I think, although, as you will see, the problem is quite a difficult one, it is capable of solution, and the conception of law as general rules, and only general rules of this type, has a precise meaning. Now, what happened with the tradition from law creation by judicial precedent to legislation was that the new legislative bodies were entrusted with two different functions which were both described as legislation. They were on the one hand entrusted with the function of improving and developing the system of laws in the sense of general rules, of laying down and improving the rules which the government would enforce upon the private individual. But the same legislative authority were also entrusted with the task of issuing orders and instructions to government about how government should organize its apparatus, how it should administer the resources put at its disposal. It became at the same time a body laying down the general rules and the democratic authority directing current government. And we acquired the habit of calling those instructions the legislative authority issued to government by the same name laws which we used for the rules applying to the relations between individuals and between individuals and the state. These were laws only in a formal sense. They were called laws merely because they derived from, or they issued from, the same legislative authority. But they were not laws in their old sense. There was no limitation on the content which such a law could have. And yet, this honored old name, which used to be confined to some general rule which everybody could accept the law, became equally applicable to a law like that of the budget, about how the government ought to spend its money, to the privilege conferred to a chartered corporation, to almost anything which the legislature resolved. It is a comparatively modern development. I doubt very much whether the English Parliament, when sometime under the reign of Henry VIII, in the beginning of the 17th century, it resolved that the cook of the Bishop of Worcester was to be boiled and quartered, it would have dared to call this a law. They would have been quite aware that while they had power to issue such an order, and while it was resolved by the legislative body, I think it would have regarded it almost as sacrilegious to describe such a thing as a law. It was just an order emanating from Parliament. But in modern times, the things have changed. In modern times, we have come to describe everything decided in the appropriate constitutional manner by the legislative assembly as a law. I think this is largely a consequence of the rise of democracy. The traditional conception that the process of legislation was especially hedged about with all kinds of limitations, was conceived to be a limitation only on the arbitrary powers of a sovereign. These controls and limitations seemed unnecessary once these powers had all been placed in the hands of a duly elected democratic assembly. And all the wisdom assembled over many centuries about the necessity of placing restrictions on the powers of the ultimate legislator were completely forgotten once it had been achieved, these powers had been put, power had been put in the hands of the people, and therefore it can no longer be abused. We are now certain that the self-interest of the people will not allow them to pass any laws which restrict their liberty. Now, the fact is, of course, that as a result of the development of the last 100 or 150 years, only a very small part of the bills which pass through Congress or through Parliament are really laws in the traditional sense. The great majority are just orders, instructions to the government to do particular things, not bound by the requirement that they are rules equally applicable to all people. And yet they have the same force, are equally binding on us, and are equally enforced by the whole coercive apparatus of government, irrespective of the fact that they may be highly discriminatory, that they may be greatly restricting the freedom of the individual, and that they may be highly inequitable. Now, perhaps you will now see why the conception that freedom is always freedom under the law, and that law is the greatest protector of freedom, seems so little applicable in our modern time. To John Locke or James Madison, it seems to be could be evident that so long as the use of coercion could only be applied in the application of a law, this was the securing of perfect personal freedom. To them, law was the safeguard of freedom. To us, law has become the great destructor of freedom. Because law is no longer what it used to be, the concept has completely changed its meaning. I personally believe that if we could restore law to its former meaning and achieve a system under which all coercion by government was limited to the execution of such general rules, we would achieve the maximum of personal freedom which we can achieve in society. But it would require a complete change in our conception of what the law is, a regaining of an old conception, and an awareness that even the fact that the majority has decided on a particular order and that it is approved by the majority does not yet make it a law in the old sense. Now that puts upon me two further tasks for today's exposition. I think I ought, in the first instance, to explain somewhat more in detail that a revival of the concept of all government activity limited by the rule of law would be a sufficient safeguard to freedom. That is all we can hope for and all we can aim at. And if we could achieve it, we would really have achieved that kind of free society we have. And second question, is there a possibility of such constitutional arrangements which should prevent such a development as has occurred in the last 150 years, which could prevent the intention which undoubtedly the fathers of the American Constitution had of limiting government by that Constitution really effective? Because I am personally convinced that they thought by creating a government of law, they had effectively limited government. And their intention has been circumvented by this change in the meaning of law which I have been describing, of which they didn't dream of yet. When they wrote, or they said, that government must coerce a private citizen only when it is provided by the law, they meant that it must be provided by a general rule equally applicable to the citizen, and not by some rule like that of Congress saying that a man of an income below 200 per month has such and such special privileges. That would certainly not have been a law in the classic sense. My first task can hardly be adequately discharged in a few minutes. It's one of the most disputed points among present-day libertarians. I haven't convinced many yet that the rule of law, in my sense, is a really sufficient safeguard to liberty, and I will even admit that I'm aware that I've probably not yet sufficiently defined the character of the admissible type of laws and their distinction from mere orders to satisfy or to meet all criticism. It's a major task because it's a task which jurisprudence has disregarded for the last 150 years. In the beginning of last century, particularly in this country, you still find in the discussion and even in state constitutions a great many attempts to draw such a line of distinction between two laws and specific orders. But about 1820 or 1830, these attempts disappeared. It was given up as a bad job, or rather it was felt to be an obstacle to certain new ambitions. And, well, I suppose it was really in the Jacksonian era when democracy became more important than the rule of law, that anything which would have implied a limitation on the power of the majority became discredited and went out of favor. All I can do here on this first point is to sketch or to illustrate by a few instances what under such a system government could do and what it could not do. I believe indeed that this distinction provides an adequate demarcation between a range of government activities which is under no circumstances permissible, and another range of potential government activities which have to be examined for their expediency, most of which are still very foolish and futile, but which have to be objected or refused not on the grounds that they are in principle incompatible with a free system, but on the grounds that it costs too much or will not achieve what we expect from another grant. My thesis is that all activities of government which require that government should treat different people differently, that should allow X to do what Y is not allowed to do, all government activities which involve coercion of other people on a discretionary basis, must in principle be prohibited. That this is inherent in the basic idea of the rule of law. But all government activities which it consists in enforcing rules equally applicable to all people uniformly without respect to persons, are in principle admissible, cannot be ruled out of hand as incompatible with a free system. All the moustache rules will be foolish and silly, but they have to be rejected on the grounds that they will not achieve what they are meant to achieve, that they will do more harm than good, or some other ground, and not on the principle that they are incompatible with a free society. Let me illustrate this in the economic field. What could government still do under such a system, and what could it not do? I claim that under such a system, government would be unable to regulate prices, quantities of goods produced, or the entry into different trades and occupations. All these three things can be regulated only on a discretionary basis. There's no possible principle by which you can lay down rules about what prices ought to be. You can only control prices by giving some authority discretionary power to fix them, and then equally discretionary power to allow some people to trade at these prices and to prevent others from doing so. That becomes evident from the fact that at any price different from the market price, there will be a difference between demand and supply. Therefore, somebody to enforce such a price has to decide who is to be entitled to buy and who is not, that every system of price fixing evidently leads to rationing, and that rationing must be enforced on a discretionary basis. It's even more obvious in the case of direct quantitative restrictions, because quantitative restrictions mean that permissions are to be given to particular people which are not given to other people. And it is still more obvious in all forms of licensing or the control of entry into particular occupations, which again cannot be handled on the basis of general rules, but require discretionary powers for the government. So these main instruments of government interference in economic life would automatically be ruled out. Now let me give you one main illustration of the other case. It clearly is possible to regulate methods of production, for instance, by the general prohibition of the use of certain dangerous techniques, or by the general requirements of the use of certain safety precautions. I'm not saying that these are desirable, but I say that they are belonging to the category of government action, which, because it could be enforced by a general rule, is not on principle to be rejected, but has to be examined on its desirability in the particular instance. I think most of these regulations are silly and ineffective. But I'm quite willing to examine each on its merits, and I will not claim that every such regulation, which prohibits outright to everybody to do certain things, is necessarily incompatible with the state of liberty. When I would not say that a prohibition of discharging guns at random in any direction is a law which actually restricts liberty. It's a kind of thing which, if it is sensible, ought to be admissible. I mustn't spend too much time on this. I hope this illustration shows you what the limitation of government intervention to the enforcement of general rules will still permit and what it will exclude on principle. I will rather turn to another aspect of the same question. Would it not still be possible for government, restricted in this manner, severely to restrict personal liberty? Well, is it not conceivable that merely by a very dense net of general rules imposed upon society, our private liberty may still be very severely restricted? I don't think it will if all my three former requirements are observed, namely that the rules A are general, B that they refer only to the relations between people and not to what a person does, so to speak, within his four walls, which doesn't affect anybody else, and three that the rules must be impartial. There are a few fields where there still might be danger. You could enforce religious conformity by general rules, although I would say this affects the sphere of not the relations between people, but the private sphere of the individual and should therefore be excluded. You might say that certain rules like prohibition of alcoholic drinks or laws preventing certain luxurious expenditure would still be in the form of general rules and might be oppressive. I think the likelihood of such rules really being enforced when they had to be general and equally applicable to all people is extremely small. Remember that equal and universal applicability means, of course, that the government also has no power of allowing exemptions in particular cases. And whether prohibition could really have been enforced, it couldn't be enforced anyhow, but would have been practicable if the government had not been in the power to grant discretionary education exemptions on medical grounds or for religious purposes and so on, I think is very doubtful. I think the very fact that general rules, to be truly general, must be rules without exception and apply to the government as much as the rest is quite sufficient protection in this respect. I have no doubt you will want to ask questions on this later, and I think I'd better go on to my second main point. The question, would there have been a possibility of so designing the American Constitution as to prevent the development that's actually taking place? So as to prevent the legislature from acquiring what are in effect despotic powers, from using the creation of laws not for the protection of individual liberties but for the suppression of individual liberties. Or in other words, could the fathers of the American Constitution, if they had our present experience, they had known what has in fact happened, so designed the Constitution as to prevent this development? I believe what we have learned in the last 180 years really suggests a way out. If I'm right in believing that the confusion between true laws and mere orders issuing from government, which are also called laws, is due to the fact that these two kinds of decisions were made by the same body, the way of preventing this is putting them in the hands of different bodies. To have true legislation, the passing of such laws which can be made the basis of the coercion of individuals in the hand of one democratically elected assembly, and the direction of current government activities in the hands of another democratically elected assembly. I think we are very wise in wanting not only true legislations to be in the hand of representatives of the people, but also to have representatives of the people controlling the current activities of the government. But while we want both these things democratically controlled, there's no reason, in fact, once we think about this, every reason against the idea that it should be the same body of man who can do the same is one thing. Same body of man giving himself authority to force people and then giving the direction in what particular manner these people are to be forced. So if I had now to rewrite the American Constitution, what I would do is would to use the bicameral system, system by which the legislature consists of two houses, for an entirely different purpose. I would have one legislative assembly and one assembly which I would call the executive or administrative assembly. And I would provide that so far as coercion of the private citizen is concerned, the executive or administrative assembly, directing the government, could act only within the limits laid down by the laws agreed by the former. You would thus, on a certain level, get a relation rather similar to that between the Constitution had the current government. Just as the Constitution limits the general powers of current government, under my system, you would, on a certain level, have the rules passed by the true law-giving assembly. By true law-giving, I mean, which was limited to laying down general rules, would limit the powers which the governmental or executive assembly could exercise towards the individuals. The thought came to me in reflecting on the evolution of the two houses of British Parliament and their gradual distinction of powers. There was a long development in the course of which a lower house, the House of Commons, practically claimed for itself the exclusive power of the purse, which meant the exclusive power of a current government. And suddenly it occurred to me, what would have happened if the House of Lords in that struggle said, all right, I give you all powers over current government. But we, the House of Lords, who always have been the judicial body, reserve in turn the exclusive power of passing general laws. You can do whatever you like within these laws, but the conditions under which you can coerce a private citizen, the general rules, laws in the old true sense, are entirely our function, the House of Lords. If the people at that time had thought of this possibility, we might, by accident, have got the kind of system which I am suggesting. I believe if it were possible, which of course it isn't, I'm not really suggesting a change in the American Constitution, but if such a system were in force, I think could, or had been in force, say, since the giving of the, since the adoption of the American Constitution, it would have prevented this very development we are so afraid of. The omnipotence of government, which is entirely due to the fact that the same elected democratic body can both pass general rules and issue specific orders. That it can equally lay down the laws regulating the building and conduct of railways, or issue a law saying that a railway shall be built between New York and Pittsburgh, and that it shall be done in such and such a manner. We call both things laws, although of course a fundamentally different kind. Now, don't say this is crying over spilled milk that might have been desirable if this idea had been adopted 180 years ago, but we can't do anything about it. I am, in fact, the last person who should advocate a deliberate change in the American Constitution now. We are so fortunate of having a Constitution which, compared with anywhere in the rest of the world, works tolerably well, that you are very grateful for it in spite of its imperfections. But utopian constructions still have a very considerable value. All constitutions, as we know, have learned by bitter experience, are not really a constant feature. They develop by interpretation. And how they are interpreted depends very largely by the ideal people hold at the time. If it came to be recognized that this sort of arrangement would be a better one, and this came to be regarded as the ideal type of constitution, we might well have a gradual development in that direction without any radical change. But the other reason why this conception of an ideal constitution seems to me worth pursuing is that, of course, the United States are almost unique in the fortunate position of having an old, established, revered, and tolerably satisfactory constitution. Most of the people of the world haven't. At the present moment, a very large part of the world is on the point of giving itself new constitutions, and they are doing so under particularly different circumstances. they're doing this at a type of a superstitious belief in democracy as being the remedy for everything, and where it will be particularly difficult to establish this basic belief in the rule of law as the basis of freedom. I think to such new countries who are at the point of giving themselves a constitution, I would very strongly recommend to consider my model of a constitution, which might save them from some of the unforeseen and undesigned consequences which the change in the term law over the last 180 years brought with itself. You will probably see that I've only just skimmed on the surface of what is a very fundamental and a very fascinating problem. And if we think about the development in recent years in these terms, aware of the change which has taken place in the meaning of law, the possibilities which legislation, which are inherent in legislation, both as a means of protecting freedom and as a means of destroying freedom, according to me, as we interpret the term law, I think you will agree that it gives a key to an understanding of processes which, not only by the public in general, I'm afraid even by the so-called political scientists and constitutional lawyers at the present time, are very imperfectly understood.